We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. The Hornets have just completed a 1-3 week, losing to Portland, Sacramento, and Denver, and taking out the Minnesota Timberwolves last night in a pretty fun game to watch. Of course, some of the biggest news that we've had all season since the Chris Paul trade was what happened to Minnesota the night before when they lost Ricky Rubio for the rest of the season with a torn ACL. I'm going to try very hard not to sound gleeful about somebody's injury. Michael, so is this that long-awaited downfall for Minnesota you've been like predicting for, well, since the season started, that in the month of March they'd fall apart?
I think I did say that, and yeah, it's kind of coming together on the perfect storm. I mean, they lose that game. Rubio gets hurt. They lose the game against New Orleans, and now they're heading off for seven road games. And I think we will look back at this past week in June as the week that wound up probably, I guess, kind of sadly being the most important week for the Hornets. I mean, it just sucks that, you know, after a couple years of having the best player in the league and at least blindly believing that the Hornets had a chance to make a run for the championship, that the perhaps the best news that comes out of the season is some other team's exciting young potentially superstar player getting hurt.
Yeah, and I mean, I purposely don't watch the Timberwolves much because I have a feeling I would like end up liking them. But I mean, I really do like the way Pekovic and Love play, and adding Rubio to that mix, that's just a fun team.
Yeah, no, I mean, and for three quarters, I think Minnesota could still stay with anybody. But Ricky Rubio actually led the league in fourth quarter minutes and fourth quarter assists this year, not amongst rookies, but amongst all NBA players. He led in both of those categories, so he's a guy that they need down the stretch. He's a guy that, you know, defensively, I mean, Ridenour might still put up some similar stats. He had 10 assists in the game the other night against us, but he's not going to have that same kind of impact on the defensive end. And honestly, he's not going to, you know, fuel that team and that city and those fans with the same level of excitement. I think that beyond the court, kind of mentally is where the biggest blow will take place with the Timberwolves, and they got 24 games left, a lot of them on the road. I don't think a free fall that some are predicting, but I would be absolutely shocked if they made the playoffs.
So, just looking at the Western Conference alone, Minnesota's 21-21, Portland's 20-21, Utah's 19-21, Phoenix is 19-21, and even Golden State, a little far back, is 16-21. They all have 21 losses. So, and that's how I always like to look at teams when you're running for the playoffs, is how many games have gotten away from you, how many are lost, you can't recover those, they're out of your hands. So there are basically, five teams all with 21 losses. Do you think Minnesota has lost enough talent just with Ricky Rubio going down that they're going to fall below all those teams? Or do you think pretty much, Portland and Utah beating them is probably pretty easy to predict, but what about Phoenix or Golden State?
Yeah, I think all of those teams catch and pass Minnesota with the exception of Golden State.
Okay.
And
I think they'll end up fourth in the West then?
Fourth. This is where it gets confusing.
Fourth worst
from the playoffs. Yeah. But no, there will be four Western Conference teams that do not make the playoffs. Wait a minute.
I would actually state that seven.
There will be three Western Conference teams that do not make the playoffs. Finish ahead of Minnesota.
Finish ahead of Minnesota.
And in respect to playoffs, but not lottery. Oh, this is so confusing.
Minnesota will have the fourth worst record in the West.
Fifth. New Orleans, Sacramento, Golden State. Yes, fourth.
Okay. I'm glad we've settled that so clearly for all of our listeners.
Right. Fourth.
That's really bizarre.
But honestly, I think that they still finish with a better record than every single non-playoff team in the East. I think they might even finish, and this was a bet that we had in the past, so I'm going to have to go back to an old podcast and see what I think they could still finish with a better record than New York, even though New York makes the playoffs, but I would be shocked if their pick got better than number 11 overall. But again, 11 overall, I'll take that over pre-Rubio injury. I really think they were going to make the playoffs just with the slide that we've seen from Houston and Portland. I don't know what's going on with them. Utah and Phoenix just not quite having the talent. So I'll take the 11th pick over the 15th or 16th any day.
Yeah, and I think that's crazy. I mean, I was talking about how, looking at 21 losses is like, you look at that loss. You go east, and New York, which is the 8th seed, has 23 losses.
Right.
There are only two teams in the Western Conference who have lost more games than the 8th seed in the East.
And you would,
that's just nuts.
And see, the only reason I think that this might, I don't know what's going to happen, but basically the conferences are going to exclusively play each other from now on. I mean, a lot of the East-West matchups have already been had. There'll be a couple here and there, but Milwaukee's going to start getting a lot of games against New Jersey, Toronto, Washington, et cetera. But the weird thing is those teams seem to, go 2-2 against each other. So nobody makes any headway, So it'll be interesting, but I think Minnesota goes something like 10-14 the rest of the way, 9-15. But I still don't think that makes that pick any better than 11. So
you predict the Hornets will enter the draft probably with what? The lottery with the third worst record and the 11th worst record, essentially worth of balls? This is terrible.
I know. I don't even really know how to explain it, but no, I had a premonition a little over 2 months ago that the Hornets would finish with the fourth and 11th picks. Those things are right on about 16% of the time. So I'm going to go with it here. I think they end up with the third worst record, but get the fourth pick. And yeah, Minnesota's is 11. But speaking of balls real quick, I do want to bring something up. In our last podcast, you know, we had somebody put in a comment that the language that we used in the podcast wasn't exactly kosher. He was listening to the podcast with his son and was displeased. And I apologized immediately, assuming that it was me who dropped the filthy language. And I only recently went back and listened, and it was you, sir.
Yes, yes.
So you have anything to say?
I'm deeply sorry, and I will do my best to keep this podcast PG going forward.
Thank you very much.
I actually meant to say that when we opened it, but I got so excited at the prospect of a torn ACL that I just had to jump to something else.
I really wish. I mean, the thing that of course I want the Hornets pick to be better, but I think it sucks that he's going to miss the Olympics. To me, I wish it was some kind of injury that, you know, a knee bruise. But then again, those knee bruises knock you out for a year, apparently.
Right. Apparently, a bruised knee requires surgery.
Yeah.
Too.
It'll be interesting to watch him going forward. I think the Hornets were pretty much resigned to thinking that mini pick would be, in the middle 15 to 18 area. Do you think that now? You know, there is at least the potential of Minnesota really hitting the skids and falling, and that no longer being a playoff team. Do you think that makes the Hornets any more likely to trade that pick, any less likely, or that pick was never being?
I don't think it really has any bearing. I mean, if you were a GM and a guy came to you and said, "I have a pick," and I mean, Minnesota out of it. Let's say they're coming to you and say, "I have New York's pick, or even Boston's pick." I mean, you're going to look at that team, and they're not changing. They're middle of the pack. So you're looking at a mid rounder. I don't really think of it when I'm making trades that, oh, if I get it, it's the 11th pick, well, that's, you know, so much better than the 15th pick. I'm going to completely change my trade here. It's, I just think mid rounder, early rounder, late rounder. I mean, so I don't think it really has any bearing on that.
Yeah, the only thing that I think different, I guess almost uniquely from a Hornets perspective, is I want that Minnesota pick to be better than the Utah and Phoenix pick, because I think there's going to become a point late in the lottery, if the Hornets choose to go this way, in which the first point guard is going to come off the board late in that lottery, and I'm sure there'll be a fight throughout the tournament and through the draft process of who that point guard is, but Phoenix and Utah will definitely target a point guard, and if the Hornets could get ahead of them, they would at least have, you know, the their pick of who they would want with that. So I think it's minorly important. Like I said, the difference between 11 and 16, the Hornets could be looking at their the third best point guard prospect if Minnesota makes the playoffs.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty interesting point. I hadn't even really thought about that. Because you're right, all those teams in the mid-range who picking like maybe right before the Hornets, Minnesota's pick, I mean, Utah and Phoenix are the ones who are looking for the point guards of the future.
Right.
Golden State has theirs. And then New Jersey obviously has theirs right now. They're not going to be going for a point guard. Detroit, I mean, they have two pretty decent prospects there. Cleveland, of course. Milwaukee has Brendan Jennings. New York has Jeremy Lin. I mean, you're absolutely right. I didn't even think about that. There's a very good chance you could be grabbing the top point guard in this draft. And we'll have a discussion later whether that's, you know, your boy from UNC.
Yeah. There's a couple good ones, but regardless of who it is, just the chance to have the choice to pick your guy. Rather than settling for who's there, even if the other team, you know, wouldn't have taken the guy you consider number one, just the opportunity to have it. So just something interesting to watch. But okay, getting ahead of ourselves, talking a lot about Minnesota again. Didn't root for the Rubio injury. Sorry that he's gonna miss the Olympics, but I'll take a I'll take an 11 pick over a 16 any day. And even that, you know, 0.5% chance, I mean, that's just going to be fun on the day of the draft lottery to at least have Minnesota's balls in there. You never know.
Yeah. I do want people to realize, though, because this is what always happens every year. There is a greater chance in the upcoming lottery that the Hornets end up with a fourth or fifth pick than they will end up with the first or second pick, no matter where, first or second pick, no matter where they end up at the end of the year.
Yeah, I agree.
I just, because all the teams below them have a chance to move up into those first three spots, and if any of that happens, they get pushed down. So just wanted to point that out. It is a complete and total crapshoot, and generally really bad teams do not move up or stay, may even maintain their position. So anyways, let's talk about basketball, because we actually saw some games this week, and some of them were pretty fun.
Yeah. I think,
which one do you want to talk about first?
I actually thought that Sacramento game was pretty interesting. I mean, that was a game that long-term, best possible scenario, I guess, for the Hornets. Not, I mean, it's a win-win because not only do they get a win, but their closest bad competitor in the West
right,
actually picks up a win. So it's a two-game swing. But I just it kind of made me shudder. I wasn't rooting for the win as much as I used to, but just this the Hornets and inbound passes late in games. Does every team have this problem and we just don't know it because we don't watch them as closely, or is this something exclusive to the Hornets?
So, I mean, I think this is a problem that hits other teams too. I mean, I remember last year when against Memphis, where Marcus Thornton tipped the pass in and then ended up recovering the ball. And we ended up taking that Memphis game after that incredible fast break. That was one of my favorite plays from last year. I don't think that it's that unusual that inbounds passes, people have issues with them. They're the ones that you always end up completely flabbergasted over. I mean, it seems like such a simple thing to do, and frustration abounds whenever it fails.
Yeah, that was a tough way to lose that game. Solomon Jones was forced to start in that game. No Gustavo. I mean, that. Yep. Just look at that front line that couldn't play. Emeka Okafor, Jason Smith, Karl Landry, Gustavo Ayon. One of my favorite quotes from this week came after the Minnesota game, and you had all the Minnesota press obviously still heartbroken by Rubio's injury and whining and asking Monte, well, would this game have been different without Ricky Rubio? And Monty was like, yeah, but our season probably would have been different with Emeka, Jason Smith, Karl Landry,
Eric Gordon,
etc. Yeah, and this team has just been absolute ravage. And to, you know, to stay with the Kings in that game, who, you know, their front line, in my opinion, is their strength, even though their backcourt guys are the ones getting paid. You know, I was pretty impressed. Came in having a near triple double in this. I think this was the first game that we really saw some potential from Lance Thomas.
Yeah, Lance Thomas has surprised me a little this year. Or not this year, this last week. Because before this, I was pretty down on him. I really thought that he just didn't have the physical tools. I mean, I loved all the energy he gave. I loved how hard he tried. But he just always seemed so physically overmatched that it didn't seem like his energy was going to be able to overcome that like it can with some players. But I don't know. He's turning a corner for me. I think I might have a different take on him now.
Yeah.
But you did bring up, I mean, you brought up the injuries, and I wanna say this. I am now officially in the camp of the Hornets are milking their injuries way past any reasonable amount of time. There's no way Jason Smith should still be out because of a concussion. He suffered, what, 3 weeks ago?
I mean, Sidney Crosby's been out almost 2 years. There's no way. You can't just lump all concussions into one area. And there's so many different levels. I mean,
so you think that if the Hornets had a chance, like we're just on the edge of maybe being in playoff contention, that all these players would still be sitting down?
No, but I think that says more for the, I guess, the competitive nature and kind of the inappropriateness that the teams, you know, make their decisions based on. No, I think some of these guys could play. I think Eric Gordon would have toughed it out through the year, you know, maybe gotten surgery at the end of the year. I think a lot of things could have happened, but I mean, that's not a true scenario. So really, what is the point of being, you know, 15 and whatever, 25, as opposed to what they are right now? And I just,
yeah. So, I mean, I don't, on one hand, I don't have any problem with it. I know why they're doing it. I just think that, I don't know, Jason Smith, I just think Jason Smith's injury in particular is just kind of like, it doesn't make any sense to me. And Emeka Okafor, they don't even call this like a sprain. And he's been out for the same amount of time. He has a sore knee. I mean, why is he not playing if he's had that long?
The reason I don't believe in this conspiracy theory is because it takes two to tango. And guys like Jason Smith and Emeka Okafor just wouldn't go for it. I mean, people who really believe this believe that there's some conversation being had behind closed doors in which either Monty or Dell or both are saying to ultra-competitive guys who love to play and, you know, it's their livelihood, that no, we're going to sit you down because we want a better draft pick. Now, are they being overly cautious? Maybe, but this idea that, you know, these guys could go and be 90-95% tomorrow, but it's for some tanking reasons,
I don't know. I think you could easily get one of the doctors to tell them, you know, just to be safe, maybe we should sit you down longer, and they say okay, because really, do they really want to go out there and give it their all for a team that has no chance?
Because
that's where the Hornets
are. No doubt.
You really think all of them feel
that way?
Have you watched Ariza the last few weeks?
Okay, that's Ariza. I think Jason's. I watched Ariza when this team had a chance to contend. And I remember telling you on last year's podcast that he sits in the corner and sulks and I want nothing to do with him. So that's Ariza. I think Jason Smith would pay money to play at this point. Honestly, no doubt in my mind.
Yeah. But, okay. I wanted to have that conversation with you. Get your take on it. I'm going over the edge.
All right, Lady Gaga. Well, let's move on. The other game, a game that I think you actually covered, that I think was pretty interesting, was the Denver game. And I don't know, what were some of your takes coming away from that game?
I just thought, I mean, I actually think the primary problem for the whole game was the Hornets weren't playing Hornets basketball at all. They were sucked in to the speed game Denver was pushing. And I think I don't remember what my numbers were anymore. I had noted it down in my notebook and put it in the recap. But it was something like in the second quarter, there was 7 straight plays or 8 straight plays where the Hornets brought the ball down and took the first shot they got that was halfway decent. 7 plays in a row, and all of them they had more than 10 seconds left on the shot clock. And that's not Hornets basketball. They work that ball around and work it and work it and work it until they have the best possible shot. And their shot clock's on their back all the time, but they always end up with a pretty solid shot if they haven't turned it over. So I don't know. I just thought that they got sucked into that Denver up and down basketball, and it kind of just, over time, you just saw them slowly wear down, and Denver showed that they're just slightly better at it than the Hornets are.
Yeah, what frustrated me in that game is how does Lance Thomas get 14 free throw attempts and Chris Gaiman and Gustavo Ayan combined for 0?
Ayan looked off on that game, I'll tell you that. But, yeah, well, that's a reoccurring issue with Gaiman. Gaiman's averaging, what, 2.5 free throw attempts a game?
Right.
For a 7-foot big man who's supposed to be a great rebounder?
That's right. Yeah, no, those are guard type numbers. Yeah, I agree, but even Gustavo, but I mean, Denver actually, you know, they showed that you could be physical with them and Thomas could get to the line and you could, you know, outwork those guys at times. And that was just kind of concerning to me that, you know.
So give me your take on Kamen here, cuz I'm struggling with Kamen. I mean, there's no question he's a chucker. that he takes way too many fadeaway jump shots. I mean, not just that aside, forget about the fact that he takes way too many shots for the amount of points he produces. When he's in the paint, there's always this premise that centers who take up a lot of space in the paint, impact defenses, even if they're not amazing rebounders. Kamen is a decent rebounder with it numbers wise, but is he? I mean, does his just being there, being a big, tall guy with long arms who can rebound the ball at a decent rate, is he actually helping the team's defense enough? I can't figure it out. At times, it seems like he's doing enough that he's actually impacting things, but then you go and look, and like last night game, I actually came away from that game against the Timberwolves, and I'm like, Kamen had a pretty decent game, and you look at the numbers, he's got 6 rebounds. And, you know, Kevin Love had that in a quarter, and Pekovic had that in a quarter.
Yeah.
And he was responsible for containing them.
Yeah, I really think it's matchup dependent. No, I don't think that he's a you know, top 10, top 12 rebounding center, but you also got to remember some of the teams in this league that, you know, just have big guys that if we had to cover, you know, even the I don't know, looking across the league, I mean, who's Milwaukee starting now with Bogut? I mean, they're pretty much playing Drew Gooden at the center position. So, I mean, I guess it's all case dependent. And Minnesota, which I didn't understand in your preview, you said that they're not a great rebounding team, but they're number one in rebounds per game.
So that's one of the things that I focus on is really offensive rebounding percentages. Defensive rebounding percentages has a hell of a lot to do with shooting and a lot less to do with rebounding in a lot of situations. So if you're a good defensive team forcing bad shots, you're going to have a higher defensive rebound rate. And there's also the whole diminishing returns thing. If you put a great rebounder into a team, how does that impact other players' rebound numbers and things like that? But offensive rebounding is almost purely correlated to a player's ability and their ability to get those extra possessions. So, I mean, I probably should have specified that because I actually looked at that. But as an offensive rebounding team, they're purely ordinary, which shocked me. I figured that they were going to be great, but they're not.
Yeah, I'm sure Kevin Love fading out to the perimeter has more to do with that. Speaking of, you said you don't watch many Timberwolves games. Mm-hmm. You obviously watch this one, but just from what you've seen, do you feel I think I've said this from the beginning of the season that I think Kevin Love's a top 5 player. Do you feel that other teams guard him the way that top 5 players are usually guarded, you know, as far as how much attention is given, or do you find it a little odd that he's given a little too much room, not double teamed near? I mean, LaMarcus Aldridge was double teamed from the second the Hornets got in that, you know, in the game with Portland. And Love, so, just I never see teams defend him the way I would think a top 5 player is defended.
So I'd actually disagree a little bit with that. I think that when Love catches the ball in the post, the Hornets doubled him pretty quickly. But I think Love's offense is just so much more intelligent than that, that it's almost I mean, how many ISOs did you see him get in that game? It wasn't a lot. He operates moving off the ball and running the pick and roll, and then having like these brilliant moves into the, like slashes into the paint for quick passes that he can finish. He's great at finishing with contact around the basket, and of course, you know, his rebounding contributes tremendously to those kinds of shots. I do think that he gets he does get less respect, particularly from the national media. His numbers alone are beyond insane.
Yeah.
I mean, those are Kevin Garnett numbers.
Oh.
From Kevin Garnett peak years.
Beyond that. I mean, they're beyond what Garnett and Duncan. I mean, even Duncan in his prime.
Right.
Didn't put up stuff. And that's what I'm
saying. And you can say Garnett and Duncan were better defensive players, and I'm not going to disagree with you.
Right.
But I think Kevin Love, calling him, like, worse than adequate. I mean, he's average at best, at worst. Right. He's solid. So I agree. I think I don't know what it is, but he is not accorded the respect that he deserves.
No, No, and I'm going to be interested to see how that changes as Rubio's gone now. But another guy, and I've kind of brought up this point before with Aminu as far as us judging him on his expectations, but you said after the Minnesota game last night that you know, you kind of have a different perspective on Aminu, and I'll just, before you kind of talk about what that perspective is, I'll say over the last three games this week, averaging about 20 minutes, 7 points, 6 rebounds a game on 90% shooting from the field. So what's your new perspective on Al-Farouq?
So, I mean, that's a fluke, the 90% shooting. I mean,
it's going to continue.
Right. That's his new future, 90% from the field. So I just had to reset my expectations about Al-Farouq. I mean, I realized I was watching that game and I was saying, hey, Lance Thomas isn't that bad. And then it's because my expectations for Lance Thomas are he's going to struggle to stay in this league.
Right.
And now I'm watching him like, you know, he could be. I actually thought to myself, you know, if he keeps working at this and he gets like a decent mid-range shot, he has a chance in this league to be a ninth man on a team. And then I watch Aminu, and I've said stuff like, oh, he's done. Get him out of here. He's probably not going to be in the league soon. You know, best, he's like an 11th man. But there isn't much difference between them, except Aminu has all the physical tools in the world, and Lance Thomas doesn't. And Aminu's actually, he's got a high engine. He works pretty hard out there. He just makes dumb mistakes a lot. And so, I mean, I just got to adjust my expectations, and my expectations were set because he went, what was it, 7th or 8th in the draft?
Yes.
That he was a game changer or a starter, and he's not. So just say, okay, throw out his draft position, look at him as just a player, and I'm fine with him being on the team. He's not paid insane amounts of money, even though he was taking the 8th pick. He's not going to break our bank in the future, because who's going to pay him insane amounts of money? And I do think, as time has gone on, he probably does give you a little more than he takes away when he comes off the bench. So I'm fine.
Yeah, and again, last time I'm going to say this point probably until our draft preview shows, but I went back and I've looked at every single prospect that I could see the Hornets taking with either their own pick or the Minnesota pick, and I think I came across 19 guys I could see them taking, and Al-Farouq Aminu is younger than 6 of them. Henry is younger than, I think, 8 or 9 of them. So, again, everybody wants to accumulate these number one picks and get these young guys. Henry and Aminu are young guys, and talking about Henry, mm-hmm. he's hitting his free throws now. That was something that we said when he starts to do, and there's no reason he shouldn't. He's always been a good free throw shooter, that he could become a solid role player in this league. Thoughts on Xavier this week?
Watching him, and he went. I called it out in one of my recaps. He's actually been going right. Yeah. Did you see that?
Yeah, 3 times I think he said.
He 3 times in that one game, and then last night against the Timberwolves, he went right 2 more times. Now both those times he went right, he lost one off his foot, and then the second time he dribbled into trouble. But at least he's going right, which is nice. But honestly, the things I've seen from Henry, his willingness, his aggressiveness, those things are all the things I'm kind of missing in Aminu on the offensive end. He makes a decision and he goes after it. And he'll, if he can't make a clean shot, he'll try to find a foul. And that's what you kind of want for a shooting guard. I actually am willing to go out now and say that I think that Henry will be a starting shooting guard. Maybe not for the Hornets, but for probably, you know, at least 4 or 5 years of his career.
For the Bakersfield Jam or in the NBA?
In the NBA.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I could see that. I mean, I was going to ask you, with the full training camp to work with Monty and the system and actually get some practice time, where would you rank? I know I'm not going to ask you to go through all the benches, but just an approximate of a bench of Vasquez, Henry, Aminu, Jason Smith and Gustavo next year.
I would probably classify that as one of the better benches in the league.
Yeah.
Without it, I mean, there might be the Bulls. The Bulls bench is better, but you know that's a championship team. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any other team that's just blows that away. Maybe the Spurs.
So then all you got to do is get stars and starters.
Right, that's the easy part.
We're almost there.
That's what the first round picks are for.
anything else about this week before kind of moving on to some of the trade chatter and draft and future stuff?
No, I mean, Foot hasn't impressed me yet. I found it interesting that Solomon Jones, they said, we think he plays harder as a on a 10-day contract than he will if we actually sign him for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Makes me wonder if something happened there, like right before that abysmal game that he started, they went to him and said, yeah, we'll probably sign you for the rest of the year, and then he went out there and didn't put any effort out there. I have been noticing that as this season goes on, Monty has been playing more and more players just purely because they're giving him the energy he desires. And he's been pulling some players and shortening their rotations because they're not.
Isn't that kind of fun to watch? Like, I watched Jeff Foote's first, minute or two, and he's running around. He's all excited. He wants to set picks for everybody. He's trying to set picks during free throws.
And Jack is waving him away.
Yeah, no, I got it. But that's so exciting when you see it. I mean, this team isn't going anywhere. It's just nice to see, you see that hunger and you just – I guess as a fan, you just always wish that even in a player's eighth year in the league after he's already made $140 million, you just hope that they could come out still on a Wednesday night and play like that. So when you see these 10-day guys, it's kind of fun to watch.
And actually, what I want to see the Hornets do for the rest of the year is just cycle in big men from the D-League and give them 20-day auditions with this Hornets.
Yeah.
To see which ones, because honestly, so let's say Jeff Foote suddenly blows up and over the next 15 days, he averages a nice, 10 points and 7 rebounds a game for the Hornets, and he's playing pretty well, and he fulfills every expectation we could have for a guy trying to make it in the league. I mean, there's still no reason to sign him for the rest of the year because you could just call him in the summer. No one is going to pick somebody
right,
and just lock them up immediately because they had a nice stretch with the Hornets. So try out a bunch of guys, figure out which ones you might like, and then get your fifth big man over the summer and from those guys you auditioned.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. So I think we'll see a bunch of them kind of cycling through unless the Hornets pull off some kind of one for three trade in which they're, and I think that was a big part of it too, is you don't want to sign Jones to a contract and then, make a swap of, let's say, came into the Rockets for 3 or 4 of their, younger guys. And now all of a sudden you got to shed one of those or you're just eating money. And
yeah,
it was pretty pointless to get Solomon on a full 1 year contract. So yeah, that's the week that was, I'll say, best possible scenario for the Hornets come the May lottery, come the June draft. Guess moving forward, it seems like the trade chatter has died. Do you see it as the quiet before the storm, or do you think this is going to be a year in which not only the Hornets but the NBA in general just really don't make any moves?
So I think in general, I think this is going to be a really quiet trade deadline. I mean, there aren't a lot of those really big contracts sitting out there that you can trade for the expiring person. And people are kind of wary about making any real trades with the new CBA rolling around and having that space this summer. But just speaking Hornets by themselves, I know that Dell Demps would never want to let people know what his plans are and let that information leak. But as I think we saw with Chris Paul, when you insert a whole nother entity that isn't even local, the chances of leaks is pretty high with the Hornets. And the fact that we're not hearing anything makes me feel like it's not very likely the Hornets are going to do anything either.
So, I mean, do you think that's from their perspective? Are they asking for too much? Do they not really have commodities that other teams want? Do you think it's in the Hornets' best interest to kind of stay still and just let all this money fall off? Why would you think that is?
Well, I mean, actually, I think at this point, they've already established every opportunity they have. And now they're just waiting to see what happens. And, I mean, it's like, I'm sure that Dell Demps at this point has already found out these are the four teams that are willing to offer something for Chris Kamen. And I've asked for this, and this is how close they've come to it. And I'm not going to change my stance. So we'll wait and close to the deadline and see if any of them change their tune, because other people they're interested in are no longer available. But I don't see any of the Hornets' assets on the market as the guy that has to be gotten. You know, I mean, maybe the Celtics would feel that way about, say, like Chris Kamen. We have to have Chris Kamen if we want to make any noise. But is that really true? Are there any pieces like Carl Landry or Chris Kamen that the Hornets would have on the market right now that could turn a playoff bubble team into a surefire playoff team, or a surefire playoff team into a contender?
I would say the first one, yes. I look at a team like Houston, and to me, Kamen, I think, ups their playoff chances considerably, and I guess it would just come down to, Houston is not winning the West no matter what they do, but financially, I would imagine the difference between making the playoffs and not making the playoffs, you know, be a couple million dollars. It would be worth taking that on, but is that worth the New York pick? And the irony for Houston is if Houston makes the playoffs, they actually lose their pick to Utah. So think about it. If Houston makes the trade for Kamen, and let's say they give up the Knicks pick, they're actually trading two first-round picks versus if they don't trade for Kamen and they just miss the playoffs. I don't know how much of that thinking is going into it. I don't even know how much more it cares about picks. I actually saw a pretty interesting tweet today that Houston is the only team over 500 that is not starting a player who's a lottery pick.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Yeah, and when you think about it, I mean, I don't know how much Morey values a late first round or mid first round pick over a second rounder anyway. But yeah, there's just so many interesting situations out there, and you got so many different factors.
Let me add something there about Houston. Like last podcast, you talked about Kyle Lowry. And how you couldn't believe, how could he become untouchable? Well, here, let me tell you. So everything I've read about Houston and Daryl Morey is he's actually one of the really strong believers in that basketball value site or the numbers behind basketballvalue.com, mm-hmm. which does the adjusted plus or minuses, which supposedly controls for a player's contributions against what players he's playing with. I don't understand the numbers myself particularly well, but I'm always a little leery about it. Kyle Lowry is in the top 15 in the NBA. When you look at it over a two-year span, he is a top 15 player according to that stat. So the good news is our buddy Chris Kamen is number one for the New Orleans Hornets. According to that stat, and he is in the top, looks like he's 32, about. He's number 32. So Houston might be a likely landing place if they really put a lot of faith in that number.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I still think Kamen is the most likely one to be moved, although my bold prediction in the last podcast was that it was going to be Okafor and there's some rumors that came out today that had Hornets Nation panicking, one of their favorite pastimes, which I can't blame them for with with the history, but the report was essentially that the Hornets were willing to give up one of the first rounders, presumably Minnesota's, just to unload Okafor.
Would you do that?
I was going to ask you, but I guess you put me on the spot.
I didn't want to answer.
No, I mean, to me, I've got to have faith that if an owner is going to come in and buy this team, that at least he would be willing to amnesty Okafor for that final year. I think without that amnesty, I would seriously consider it. With the power of having the amnesty, I just, unless the owner is a penny pincher, I just can't imagine that if the Hornets could become real free agent players in that 2013-14 season, and you know the owner has the option to amnesty Okafor, that he's not going to do it. I mean, to me, that's just kind of going to be a cost of buying this team down the line if they can't move him. So you're basically asking, am I going to give up the 10th or 11th pick just for the ability to get Okafor's salary off the books next year, a year in which the Hornets already have a ton of cap room and probably aren't going to be huge players in the free agent market? No, to me, that move just doesn't make any sense. But what I'll ask you to do is now play devil's advocate and tell me why that move might make a little bit of sense.
Why would it make a little bit of sense? Because they don't have $12 million of salary on their cap every year, and they can extend. They feel they can extend Kamen, and that he's a better player than Okafor.
But you can't do that with Okafor on the. I mean, why
you could
you just
but
slide Kamen into Landry's expiring.
Yeah, that depends on what the contract Kamen's actually asking for. What I mean, if Kamen's coming back and saying, I'll stay with the Hornets, but you have to pay me $22 million for the next 2 years.
Then the Hornets say no. There's absolutely no way. I mean, I would actually be more open to the idea of shedding Okafor if the Hornets were going to go after some free agents this summer. Let me read you, you know, the crop of...
Just before you get to all your free agent plethora, I think you're being a little inconsistent about Chris Kamen here. Because, I mean, you keep pointing out stuff about, like, say, you know, Marc Gasol and Sam D'Alembert and how, you know, you always thought that they were going to be getting big, pretty massive contracts. Chris Kamen is averaging pretty nice numbers this year. You don't think he's going to be, you were saying, like, what, 26 over 4 years?
Yep.
You think that's a reasonable number?
I don't think he gets over $7 million a year.
Why do you think that? I mean, he is a big man in a league that always needs big mans, and Sam D'Alembert just got, what, $7.5 million a year? And he's not as good as Kamen.
First of all, D'Alembert got a contract that just so happens to run out at the exact time when the new essential hard cap comes into play.
Right.
And D'Alembert got 2 years, $13.7 million. But if you notice, the Rockets didn't give him a penny in 2013-14. Kamen is coming into this in the wrong time. I think he's going to have two options. He'll have the option of 1 year, $10 to $12 million. He could get his 1 year paycheck, but I'm telling you that once it goes in to that 2013-14 year, if you're not a guy with ridiculous upside and potential that could be a top five center in this league, you're just not getting paid. And the reason I believe that is because I saw what happened time after time this summer. I mean, guys like D'Alembert, guys like Chris Humphreys, Carl Landry, they would have got paid 3, 4, 5 years ago under the old CBA, and they would have gotten multi-year contracts. It's no coincidence those guys all got 1 and 2 year deals. I'm telling you, if you're not a star, a potential star, or a superstar, you're just not going to be getting paid anymore going into that 2013-14 season and beyond. So I think Kamen would be an idiot to reject 4 years, $26 million. And that's why I'm saying I don't really see the point in amnesting Okafor just to slide in Kamen when Kamen could come in at less than what Carl Landry's number is this year. So
Okay.
But
all right, so let's get on to your list of free agents you're excited about.
So this is what I'm saying is that if you want to get rid of Okafor because you're dense and you have your eye on one of these young early 20 centers that you want to put next to Gordon and hopefully Anthony Davis, then maybe I could buy that argument. So you'll have restricted free agents coming out this year. Roy Hibbert, JaVale McGee, who kind of makes me squirm just saying the name, but JaVale McGee. You'll also have both of the Lopez brothers and my dark horse, Omer Azik from Chicago. All of those guys you could throw a contract at and force the team to match. You have numerous options there. So I guess if I'm Demps and I have my eye on one of those guys, particularly Brook Lopez. I mean, if Dwight Howard's going to New Jersey and they're just going to get him in free agency. I don't know why you couldn't get Lopez and force New Jersey to match, which they wouldn't. But anyway, so you got a bunch of young centers. All those guys I listed were 25 or younger. If you want to move Okafor because you're dead set on getting one of those guys, maybe I could buy it. But any of those guys that you like for the future moving forward and be willing to give a decent sized contract to.
So what if they were moving Okafor so he did get offer, came in $8 million a year and then go after somebody else entirely? I mean, you don't have to go for a center if you got Kamen because you still got Jason Smith, still got Ione, and you still got, the whoever becomes Solomon Jones and your first round draft pick.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason you have to keep Okafor at this point. They've got some depth. I mean, I still think Okafor is the best center of the bunch that we're talking about. I think I still like Okafor more than Kamen, just not at, $5 million more per year to start with.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think, I just think that Minnesota pick is a little too much okay. to give up just to shed him, especially I don't think it's going to be impossible to shed Okafor moving forward, or at least amnesty him. If I didn't have that amnesty option, I would consider it. But so yeah, that was the Okafor scenario. I don't know what else. I mean, it feels like we're trying to force something out of nothing. But I mean, what do you think accelerates possible trade talks? Do you think it would be a major injury happening in the NBA? Do you think that perhaps an arms race occurs where one team gets somebody and gets somebody else, or perhaps just a game like the Lakers had with the Celtics today in which they pull out a hard-earned victory and now they get themselves to believe that they're contenders?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's possible, because here's the thing that breaks down every time I keep hearing they're waiting for that first domino to drop, which is Dwight Howard. Dwight Howard's potential suitors are the Mavericks and the Clippers and the Nets. I think that's the list of three that he wants, and maybe, one or two others could be, roped in there if they had to. What real incentive does Dallas or the Nets have to, break the bank in this trade? They can just sign him in the offseason. So, and they don't have, a James Dolan sitting in the front office who's calling Isaiah Thomas and saying, what do we do? And Isaiah Thomas saying, trade every single good piece you have to get Dwight Howard right now and don't care what's left. I mean, that's not happening with, I don't think, the Nets or Dallas. So I don't think any of those teams have any real incentive to up their offers, which is what I think would make Dwight Howard move somewhere, and that would start the domino. So I think people are going to wait for it to happen and hope it happens, and then when on Thursday rolls around, realize it hasn't happened yet and say, oh, well, what little tweaks can we do around the edge, and let's get those done.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we've at least seen that Dell is going to be aggressive on that and maybe could get in on as a third or fourth team, but I just I wish we knew a little more about the ownership situation. I mean, do you think that some of the reports that we're hearing are true, that it goes to the extent of Dell not only having to go to David Stern for approval, but also having to keep the potential owners in the loop. I mean, I know that he's probably not authorized to take on salary, but, you know, what, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know if I believe that or not. I mean, unless that group has a stranglehold and it's an absolute 100% certainty that they're going to take control of the team, which if that case was the case, we've been probably hearing more about it right now. Then I can't see why Dell would have to be getting approval from two different groups at that point. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm really hoping it's not going to be the completely dead trade deadline like I feel it might turn out to be. And, you know, maybe I'm a prisoner of the moment, like you like to call me, that, like, right now there's nothing happening, so clearly nothing will happen 3 days from now. It is kind of lame to be saying that, but I just have, that's my gut feeling right now.
Yeah, no, I think the West is so wide open, it's absolutely shocking to me that more of these teams aren't making a move, and it's, you know, it's going to be surprising if they continue not to, and, I don't know. I guess we'll just see as we get closer. But I don't know. If you had to guess, I guess I'll just ask you this way: opening day, starting lineup for the Hornets next year, who is starting at center?
Emeka Okafor.
All right. We shall see.
So should we talk about what's coming up this week?
So what do we got on the schedule? There's three or four games?
So on tap, we have a game Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday. So four. And it is not Murderer's Row whatsoever. We get to beat the poop out of Charlotte on Monday. Los Angeles rolls into town on Wednesday. The Lakers, not the Clippers. And Washington and New Jersey close out the week Thursday and Saturday. So, you know, basically this is actually showtime, because this is the three of our chief competitors for worst team in the league get to roll into town, and we'll see what happens. I can't imagine us losing to Charlotte ever, because Charlotte is, I think somebody else made this joke before. I don't think that they could enter the NCAA tournament and have any belief they're going to make it past, like, the Sweet 16.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Really? Just because they got Kemba Walker?
They would kill. They'd beat every team by 30-plus points.
They're starting Boris Jaw at center.
Not anymore. That guy got sent away.
Yeah, he did. But still, B.J. Mullins, he couldn't even play for his college team.
He's balling now. I don't know. But, I don't know. When I saw they were going to play this game, I just really started thinking about how did Charlotte get this bad? Because it's hard to be this bad and really not have much going for you, because you would think that, you know, they would have a couple of top three picks on the team by now, but they really don't. And they got this bad because they followed the formula that those who, you know, who were bashing the Hornets for taking the Clippers trade instead of the Lakers ones were going to take. I mean, Charlotte, you look at their picks. I mean, Gerald Henderson was a 12th overall pick, and they were always drafting in that 9, 10, 11, 12 range. DJ Augustine, you know, you could go down the list.
Sean May.
Yeah, and they were always just bad enough to not make the playoffs or just hinge on it. I mean, they were the exact recipe for what you don't want to do, and now they're paying the price for it, and I don't think they're getting out of it anytime soon. So, you know, the first thing I thought about when I watched this, when I saw this game on the schedule, was that's why I'm glad the Hornets took the Clippers trade, because they'll be bad this year. They'll essentially get two lotto picks and Eric Gordon and whatever stud they grab in the top five. And I think if you look at Hollinger's power rankings, the Hornets are like 23rd in the league. They're much higher up than a lot of teams who actually have better records. They're not that bad of a team. They've had injuries this year, and Charlotte is just exactly what you don't want to do. So,
yeah, I mean, basically they've spent their entire 3 years just trading away assets, young assets, and for mediocre veterans. I mean, it's going after Steven Jackson. It was ridiculous. They traded away essentially what was the rights to Brandon Wright for Jason Richardson.
Right.
I mean, they traded draft picks for Tyrus Thomas, which, of course, now that's biting them in the rear. They've traded for Jopp. They signed Carroll to a huge thing. They gave away assets for Nahara at one point. I mean, this is not a team that's made really smart decisions for a long time. And yeah, Charlotte's pretty helpless at this point. So, I mean, I can't imagine we're going to lose to them. You brought up Washington's player, JaVale McGee, and we're going to get to play them again. So there are a lot of people who really like JaVale McGee, and there's a lot of people who really hate JaVale McGee. It doesn't seem to be any middle ground. Do you think, so if we ended up grabbing JaVale McGee, say, you know, he's got warts, so he's not going to be, you're not going to break the bank to get him. Do you think that after having been in Washington for what, is he in fourth year in the league, and have been part of this dysfunction for so long, and do you think he has a chance? Do you think he's worth a flyer? Say you could get him for $7 million a year for 3 years.
No, I don't. I think McGee is at a weird place. I think it's both too early and too late to get McGee. I think this is what I say a lot of times. People act like a player who came out of the draft that's either been successful or unsuccessful would have been that same player in any situation. I completely disagree. I was, you know, watching the Lakers game today, and Bynum is a certifiable star, but I really think that I could have placed him on 10 or 12 teams, and, you know, he wouldn't have been half the player that he is now. He went to an organization that, you know, expects greatness, and, you know, eventually was brought along by some veterans. I think the opposite has happened to McGee. I think he was put in one of the worst possible situations. But the irony is, I also think it's too early to grab him now because I don't think he's been beaten down enough and has had enough humility. I think of a guy like Zach Randolph, who really didn't get it till he was about 28 years old, and he was just tired of being completely selfish and not winning. And I think McGee's going to get a contract from somebody, disappoint that team, and you know, maybe grow up 4 or 5 years from now. But I don't think now is the time when I'd be willing to gamble on him.
Yeah, I mean, you look at him just numbers wise, and 19 PER. He's, you know, 27 minutes. He's putting up an 11-9. But I wouldn't touch him. And especially they're talking about how if you could have McGee right now if you take Blatch and his 3-year contract off my hands. I wouldn't touch Blatch with a 10-foot pole that you're holding.
Yeah, Blatch is a nightmare. And I remember back about 2-3 years ago when the David West trade rumors were going, Blatch was actually a guy that a lot of Hornets fans targeted as you know, a young guy to get for him, right along with J.J. Hickson. Again, another guy who's a bust. And yeah, no, I find it interesting with McGee, and I think if he was in a veteran situation, maybe, but no, he's just not a guy that I'd want. And I was actually listening to one of the Basketball Jones podcasts right after the All-Star break, and they were making bold predictions. And one of the guy on there predicted, his bold prediction, sure to come true, was that JaVale McGee will score a basket on the wrong bucket this year. And he said he would log it down, he would take that to Vegas. I mean, he's just had an epic season of brain farts, mental mistakes, and, you know, it's bad. But I really think that guy gets drafted by the right team, and he's a totally different player, and you know, that's just always the interesting part for me is that certain guys would just work out so much better in completely different places, and trying to think about the right type of fits for the Hornets in this upcoming draft. But
all right, so here's the rub. Three teams, we had a week with three teams that are all pretty bad, and the Lakers. What's the record?
I'm going to go 2-2, and I'm going to say the Lakers are going to be one of those victories.
You know what? You read my mind. That was exactly what I was going
to
say.
They're going to lose one of these games to one of these horrible, either Charlotte or Washington. I don't know which one, but they'll beat the Lakers.
I think they're going to take the middle two games and lose. I mean, sorry, they're going to take the first two games and lose Washington and New Jersey at the end of the week.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, Washington's the type of team. What's funny, though, is I'll check out a Washington game. I'll look at the score right before a Hornets game starts, and Washington's down like 43-11. Like, that's happened multiple times this season. Like, I have no clue. You know, they're probably one of the teams that I've barely watched, along with Charlotte, which I don't think anybody's watching Charlotte. I just read something today that the Charlotte Observer don't even send their beat reporters to cover the Bobcats on road trips most of the time.
Wow.
That's just that. I mean, that nobody cares about that team, but anyway, I digress. So yeah, I go 2-2. You're saying 2-2 as well with Charlotte and Los Angeles being the victories.
Yeah, I think for some reason, and it says something about that Lakers team. The Lakers, they get up for big games, and they let teams take them, and it's on the road. And the Lakers have a really bad road record this year. They're 7-14.
Yeah,
I mean they're 18-2 at home, and 7-14 on the road. How do you do that?
I don't know, but yeah, that game will be right before. The trade deadline, I mean, possible audition for Ariza, Jack, maybe even Kamen, maybe?
Yes, that's right. We'll see them all jump ship to the Lakers, and we'll get Andrew Bynum, right?
No, just take one of those draft picks. But, yeah, no, and then the trade deadline, I think the biggest part of this week by far, Thursday, 3 o'clock Eastern time, 2-2 record, we're both calling, and final prediction on the trade deadline.
I say Kamen stays put. I expect either Landry or Ariza will be gone by the end of the day Thursday.
All right, I'm going... I don't know. Let's go Kamen to Golden State for Kwame Brown. And a future first and... whatever other salaries to make it work.
Okay, that's it?
That's it.
Alrighty, with that exciting, happy note, where all of us were hoping for huge trades, which we end up with 87 first-round picks, we'll see what happens, and we'll keep you all posted, and we probably will have some special events leading up to the trade deadline that I hope you guys all tune in for. Thanks, everyone, for listening to In the Know.
And I just want to announce the $25,000 bounty is coming Kobe Bryant's way for taking out Rubio. The bounty has been doubled for Kevin Love. Hashtag, that's how we do it in New Orleans.
Right. Have a good night, guys.